Thank you, Pam. I'll have the marshal introduce the panel.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Bryan, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for July 13. This panel has five matters on its calendar, two of which are oral. This first matter, A211722, State of Minnesota Respondent, Brady Kevin Hansen, Appellant. We are proceeding via Zoom technology. And so, counsel, I assume both of you can see the clock somewhere in the corner of your screen?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. Thank you. And so the usual process, 15 minutes for appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, and 5 minutes of rebuttal, if you so choose, for appellant's counsel. We do ask that you identify yourselves for our record when you begin your statements. And I'll note also, because we are recording the proceeding, that no other recording is allowed. But within 24 hours, this matter will be on the branch's website for those to listen to. If for some reason we have any technological issues, the marshal knows to stop the clock so that you don't lose any of your time until we regain connection. And with those comments, counsel for appellant, if you would identify yourself, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Matthew Dearth. I represent the appellant, Mr. Brady Hansen, in this matter. Today, the court is asked to consider an issue of bad faith in the handling and the destruction of evidence. Specifically, when it comes to Mr. Hansen's case, the question is really, did the state and its agents act in bad faith when potentially exculpatory evidence in this case was destroyed? In this case, the lower court held that there was no bad faith and it denied
a motion. I'm sorry, Mr. Dearth, to interrupt, but I want to make sure I understand very clearly. It seems like in Hawkinson, there's one category for exculpatory evidence and a separate category for potentially useful evidence. And I think you said potentially exculpatory evidence, which kind of combined the two. And so I want to make it very clear. I didn't see an argument under a straight exculpatory evidence prong, if you will, from Hawkinson. I saw this as straight potentially useful. But I want to make sure, because your terminology kind of combined those two ideas.
And you're correct, Your Honor, and I apologize for any confusion. Mr. Hansen is not arguing anything under Brady progeny here. This is about potentially useful evidence. And I apologize if I misspoke. I think the understanding generally is that potentially useful evidence may be exculpatory, but this court is absolutely correct here. This is not a case about Brady or about apparently exculpatory evidence. Mr. Hansen, for the purposes of this appeal, is conceding that the record does not apparently support that the state would have known that this evidence would have been exculpatory. So this is an issue limited to potentially useful evidence, and that's why we're talking about bad faith today. So, and specifically when we're looking at Hawkinson, there's really a couple of questions that come up here. Hawkinson actually lists a number of different factors that are relevant here that the court should consider when it's deciding whether or not there was bad faith on the part of the state. So I'd like to recite a few of the core facts here because I think it's important to the narrative. Mm-hmm. So there were two omnibus hearings in this case. The first one was in May of 2019. At that hearing, counsel for Mr. Hansen, he'd indicated that he was challenging probable cause. He made a discovery request for what was called a cell phone dump of Mr. Hansen's cell phone, which had previously been seized by law enforcement, and that was in their custody at the time. He had indicated that the purpose of that dump was because he wanted to look at and challenge the issue of lack of consent, which is one of the elements of the underlying burglary charge. About 2 months after that hearing, counsel for the parties are exchanging emails. Those are in the record. The counsel for the prosecuting attorney at the time actually did request a password for Mr. Hansen's phone. Now, Mr. Hansen understood that his fingerprint would unlock the phone. He was unsure of the other possible combinations, the connect the dots sequences that would unlock the phone. And he knew that after a certain number of failed attempts, the phone would factory reset and all the data on the phone would be lost. He provided this information to his counsel, and that in turn, his counsel provided that information to the prosecuting attorney. Now, the standard procedure at the time, we understand from the record at the Polk County Sheriff's Office, was to take a phone and to perform a data extraction. It would actually be sent to an outside agency to do that. In this particular case, however, the Polk County...
Mr. Dearth, if I can jump in there too, because I want to be very clear about what two things. What is the conduct that we're looking at, as well as what is the standard operating procedure? Or to be even more precise than that, what does the evidence show about those two things? So as you start with this, it's bad faith because it didn't comply with a standard procedure. What is the standard procedure? Because I think the parties dispute how narrowly we should articulate that. And it seems that in the briefs, respondent is saying that it should be more narrow than you are, and that the standard procedure is when extracting data, not just for any purpose, but specifically for an investigative purpose. And that the conduct involved was not even data extraction, but that the conduct was more narrow than that too. The conduct was unlocking a phone. And there is no standard procedure in the that respondent identified in the evidence regarding unlocking phones or regarding data extraction for purposes of a discovery request, apart from a standard procedure that might apply for data extraction in the investigative context. So as you make this argument, I want to hear from you, kind of what did do you think the evidence showed the standard procedure was?
Thank you, Your Honor. So a couple of things I would note about that. First, before we discuss the procedure, I would note also the request that was made here. The request that was made by Mr. Hansen's counsel was that he get a, and I'm quoting right out of the record here, I think it's page 2 of the transcript from the May omnibus hearing, page 2, line 23, he asked for a, quote, cell phone dump. So this is not just simply, he did not ask that the state unlock the phone simply. He actually asked for a dump of all the data on the cell phone. Now, in terms of the standard procedure here, Your Honor is absolutely correct. There is a limited amount of evidence that we have in the record to support what the actual procedure was. What we have, based upon the Polk County deputy's testimony, which was at the second omnibus hearing, so that would be the June 4th transcript, page 9 at line 11, what we have is that the procedure for the Polk County Sheriff's Office at the time was to send the phone to, quote, an outside agency, end quote, to perform the data extraction. Now, that's really what we have here in the record. Admittedly, it's scant.
Was the evidence, the testimony relating to discovery requests, investigative purposes, or some other purpose?
So the testimony was, well, the testimony in this case was based upon a discovery request that had been made, and then in this particular situation, counsel actually filed a motion to dismiss based on the evidence.
But I guess I should rephrase, because my question is not about the request, but about the policy. So is the testimony about the policy, does that testimony clarify that this is a policy for investigative purposes, extraction when investigating a case, or is this a policy that applies to extraction as a result of a discovery request or some other purpose?
So in this case, Your Honor, the record really isn't clear about, in fact, I would maybe, my reading of the record, Your Honor, is that there's really not a distinction between whether it's for an investigative request separate from a discovery request. The policy that when the deputy testified at the hearing, the question that was before him was really what happens in a situation where a deputy or law enforcement is looking at the contents of a phone or attempting to get the contents of a phone. I don't necessarily think that the record here really bifurcates those two issues. The procedures for entering a phone are presumed, at least based upon this record, to be the same. There's really not, the deputy didn't distinguish between the two. And in this case, for the analysis here before the court, really the question is, what was the procedure for accessing that evidence, for accessing that data? And was there in this particular case, a substantial deviation from that practice? And here, Mr. Hansen's argument is that there was. The deputy here that was aware, he was aware of the policy that the sheriff's office had enough to testify to it at the omnibus hearing. And in spite of that, he also admittedly, without any training or experience in this matter, attempted to enter the phone. He attempted to enter the phone based upon the passwords he was given. He was also given the information that Mr. Hansen's fingerprint could unlock the phone. And despite that, and despite the offer that Mr. Hansen gave to the law enforcement through his counsel that he could appear and unlock the phone with his fingerprint, the deputy in this case proceeded to try the various passwords he was given until the phone actually locked itself and factory reset.
Mr. Durst, can I ask you about that? Just to clarify, and in response to Judge Bryan's questions, would you concede that bad faith alone does not equate, or excuse me, deviating from a practice does not equate to bad faith? The court has to look to the facts of the particular case to see whether that supports a bad faith. And if I'm correct on that, isn't it true here, and the court made findings that, but for clear error, we will assume as part of the record that the deputy followed exactly your client's instructions to try each one of these. And if you go beyond five, it will reset. And the court made a finding that the deputy was credible, that the deputy did exactly that, did the three. And so hence, the record indicates it would seem to be, even if we assume there was a deviation because of their past practice, that the deputy followed exactly what your client indicated. Wouldn't that support a lack of bad faith?
So I guess there's two parts to that question, Your Honor. First, I would absolutely concede bad faith is not proven simply by a deviation of policy. That's absolutely correct. I would respectfully disagree with the holding of the lower court in this case, finding that there was no bad faith because the deputy followed the exact instructions that that Mr. Hansen gave through counsel. I would actually disagree. First of all, the fact that the deputy followed the instructions, the deputy in this case looked at as far as we can tell from the testimony that he gave, looked at these password combinations and entered them. He was aware that based upon a certain number of attempts, the phone would actually reset itself. Now, a deputy in his position or anyone's position, knowing that a fingerprint could and would unlock a phone versus a consistently declining number of password unlock possibilities that are not proven to be known or unknown. At this point, you know, there's not really anything in here to indicate that the deputy actually believed that one of these would unlock. The only thing he knew for a fact was that Mr. Hansen's fingerprint would unlock the phone. And so
just to clarify though, your client provided those passwords and then said, if those don't work, if I understand the record correctly, my fingerprint would do it. Wouldn't this be a different scenario if he had not provided passwords? I can't remember them, but I will provide my fingerprint. That seems to be more what you're focusing on. But again, it seems like the record shows the deputy followed exactly what your client requested of them, except unfortunately, and even to your own client's knowledge, which apparently was it would take nine, after three, it reset. So there was no opportunity for a fingerprint. Isn't that part of the facts in the record that judge took into account?
It is, yes, Your Honor, it is part of the facts in the record. There's an additional fact I think that is important here, which is that Mr. Hansen did testify that upon each incorrect entry of the sequence into the phone would actually display a warning about the reduced number of remaining attempts before the phone would unlock itself. That was not anything that was controverted by the deputy at this time, Deputy Haugen. He didn't recall exactly what the warning was. And so really at this point, we're not really reweighing the credibility of the witnesses here. What we have is the testimony that Deputy Haugen would have been aware of how many attempts were remaining. And
counsel, to prevail in this case, don't you need to establish that there in fact was a destruction?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think as far as the record supports here, I think the parties agree. I don't think there's any dispute that there was a destruction here. That was indicated by the deputy. That was indicated.
Well, the deputy indicated that it reset, but some phones, you can go to the cloud and pick it up, and the service provider might be able to find another way of doing it. The record is silent as to whether any of that was done.
And that's correct, Your Honor. The record doesn't support that. I would actually also...
So my question then is simply a resetting established that there was a destruction?
So as far as the record supports, Your Honor, I don't believe, and again, I understand what the court is discussing in terms of, or what the court is asking about, whether some of this data could have been backed up on the cloud somewhere, or could the service provider have it. We don't have any evidence in the record that suggests that actually is the case, that the phone was backed up on the cloud. That wasn't a question that the state asked Mr. Hansen at the time. I don't think the record supports that there would have been a backup or that Mr. Hansen could have actually received.
Well, so my question is on the factual question of whether there was a destruction. Does the evidence support that there was a destruction simply because there was a reset?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it does in this case. If there was a reset, if the data on the phone was lost, which is what was indicated to by the state, both in the emails and also in the discussion that was had through the testimony at the June 4th hearing, mm-hmm. The evidence, as I can see, supports that the evidence, that the data on the phone would have been destroyed, that the evidence would have been destroyed as a result of that.
If the data on the phone, that's not necessarily saying that the data itself is unavailable and destroyed. So whose burden is it to rule out that possibility? Is it something the state had to ask, or is that something that as the moving party, you would have to establish that there's no other source, including testimony?
So, well, there's actually, I would say a couple of things on that point, Your Honor. The reason why we're here today is because the state indicated that the data was...
Again, my question is, whose burden is it?
So in terms of who's, well, I guess in this case, Your Honor, I think what I would say is that, you know, based upon the case law here, that when we get to this stage, I guess the only way we get to the stage is if there's been an assertion made that the data has been destroyed. So I think that for purposes of a motion to dismiss, that's already been, I see I'm out of time.
Well, you can finish your thought answer to Judge Bryan if you haven't done so yet.
Thank you, Your Honor. So for the purpose of this, has it been established that there's a destruction? Who has to prove there's a destruction? Well, I think here again, we're looking at a situation where, you know, the state has already, for our particular case, it's already been established that the state has conceded there was a destruction here. I understand that the question is whose burden is it to prove that a destruction happened? I think ordinarily, if a person is going to file a motion to dismiss, if a defendant's going to file a motion to dismiss, there has to be some level of production here that there actually has been a destruction. Well, but here, that's
the state has the state conceded that there was a destruction, or did the state simply concede that the phone was locked?
My understanding from looking at the email, I think it's document ID number 50. I think the state, then the email from the prosecuting attorney in that case said that the phone had been reset. So I believe the state.
That's my question. Does a reset equal a destruction?
Yes, Your Honor. I think a reset does equal a destruction in the sense that if the phone wiped the data off of it, so the data is no longer on the phone, then that is a destruction of data. That is a destruction of potentially useful evidence in this case.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and then you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Clifford Wardlaw. I'm an assistant Polk County attorney. I represent the respondent in this appeal. First of all, this is not a destruction of evidence case. The only thing that the sheriff investigator was trying to do was to unlock the phone. And people do that every day as part of the everyday experience. You put your passcode in.
So the state is not conceding that this was a destruction?
No, because the evidence was present from the victim's cell phone. Screenshots were taken of the text messages, the images that were sent from the defendant to the victim, that was provided in discovery. So we had that material in the discovery that was sent. So when the case went to trial, the victim was able to testify that he was texting me. He sent me a picture of my dog. I recognized the picture background as the cab of the pickup truck. So we had that evidence and disclosed that to the defense already. There is nothing in the record. And Judge Bryan's point, I think, is well taken. This is a defense motion. If defense counsel could not get the information from the cell phone because we couldn't unlock it, what other attempts were made to obtain that same information? And indeed, in this case, when you look at the record here, the defendant testified at trial. So the information could have been obtained through the defendant's testimony. The information was provided to the defense in discovery from the victim's cell phone. And the dump itself is not critical here because what the detective did with the victim was she gave him her cell phone. He went through, scrolled through the cell phone, and he was taking screenshots of text messages and photographs. And he could have done the same thing here. But the whole point of this case is that the only thing that the sheriff investigator was trying to do was to unlock the phone. It didn't matter that it would go to a third laboratory or agency to do a cell phone dump. If the phone could not be unlocked, that information on the phone was not available through the cell phone.
Now, Mr. Wardlaw, can I just clarify your answer to Judge Klopacki's question? It's my understanding the state seized the phone because it believed there was inculpatory evidence on it. And as I look at the judge's order, and I'm assuming from that, the state itself desired to see what was on the phone because it believed there, and I assume part of that may be via conversations with the victim and her phone. So I'm not quite sure I follow the issue of destruction of evidence. And if neither the state nor the defense both wanted the phone, both must have thought there was evidence on the phone. And therefore, because it was reset, nobody can get the evidence. I understood the issue to be more focused on whether it was inculpatory versus exculpatory. And of course, what's before us is whether it was actually a bad faith destruction of whether it was inculpatory or exculpatory.
Well, the point I was trying to make, Judge, was that the idea that there was whether or not there was destruction, that was something that the defense had the obligation of showing at the motion hearing because it was their motion. It wasn't what the state put before Judge Yon, who made specific factual findings that are not clearly erroneous, was that this was nothing more than an attempt to unlock a cell phone. That's all the deputy was trying to do. And that there was no act by the deputy sheriff that resulted in the destruction of evidence. My point was that evidence was available from alternative sources and provided to the defendant. Were there more pictures on his cell phone of Benji in the cab? There could have been, but that's not exculpatory, that's inculpatory. And indeed, when you look at the federal cases cited in my brief, I believe it's Watkins and Williams, which did involve the destruction of evidence, the federal court said there are two things that the court is to consider. Number one, was the defendant prevented from mounting a defense? And he wasn't. And it's important to note in this case, what the defendant claimed at the motions hearing was consent. She gave me consent to enter the home to take care of her dog. That's not what he testified to at trial. He testified at trial, I didn't go in the house. I opened the door, the dog came running out, the dog ran into my truck cab. And so you have a situation here now where he's in the middle of this case is now asserting a defense that has nothing to do with the information on the phone. Nothing on that phone would have shown whether or not he went into the house or he didn't go into the house. But his initial defense was consent. I had consent to enter the home, which the victim testified he didn't. So the second point I would like to make here is bad faith. All of the cases Hawkinson talks about, Hawkinson is actually a destruction of evidence case. The blood sample in the DUI case was destroyed, and that was done by kind of the normal administrative process of taking care of evidence, and blood samples are destroyed after a year. Here, there was nothing done by the state to destroy evidence. The only thing that was done was trying to unlock the phone. And it's important to note when you take a look at Judge Yon's specific factual findings that are entirely appropriate is that this happened after three attempts using passcodes that the defendant provided. The information that defense counsel had provided to the deputy was that it would be five attempts. Well, that wasn't true because the defendant then said, after nine attempts, something comes up and 10th attempt, then it would lock. So the court certainly found what the defendant testified to was not credible. and what the deputy did testify to was credible. And her finding that the deputy did not act with a bad intent is certainly supported by the record. There's no showing of bad faith here. And because of the failure to show bad faith by the defendant, this appeal should fail. So I'd ask the court respectfully to deny the appeal and to affirm the finding of the district court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, I see no other questions. So counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So first of all, just about the issue of whether this was a phone dump versus in terms of a data extraction, whether this is a phone dump versus simply unlocking the phone. Again, looking at, I think it's document ID number 50, the actual email exchange between the prosecuting attorney, defense counsel, and the investigator, or the deputy in this case, everybody calls it a phone dump. So this wasn't just a simple situation where the deputy was going to be unlocking the phone and looking at pictures or text messages. The reason why the phone dump itself, why the actual cell phone dump is takes place in cases like this, is because it's not just a matter of looking at what is in the text application at the time or in the phone log at the time. The real issue here is, and again, why would the state, why would the investigation in this case require that Mr. Hansen's cell phone is seized? Because one thing that law enforcement is going to need to do is verify what they're actually seeing. Both from the victim here and then also from, in this case, Mr. Hansen. People can delete text messages right on the application on their phone. People can delete call logs. People can delete pictures. The only way to really know whether there was exculpatory evidence or not, here we're talking about potential useful evidence, is to take a look and see what was actually on Mr. Hansen's phone.
Do you have to unlock a phone to do what you're referring to kind of informally as a phone dump?
So, Your Honor, my understanding, and again, this is just based on the record, but the deputy, the email from the deputy, again, part of, I think it's document ID number 50, says that that they do need to unlock the phone in order to actually perform the dump. So the phone would have to be unlocked somehow. It's really not, I don't think that there's any ability for them to break into the phone, as it were, because in this case, what was indicated by the deputy here is that the data was actually encrypted. So the phone would have to be unlocked somehow.
So isn't there a distinction then between the conduct here taken to unlock the phone and the conduct here that was not taken, which would have been to extract the data? Isn't there a distinction that we should make between those two things?
So there is a distinction, Your Honor, but the result is the same here. What law enforcement should have done was sent it to the BCI or to some outside agency. We're not sure which agency their policy was. And presumably that agency would have had the skills or at least the professionalism to actually look at the situation here, acknowledge that Mr. Hansen could unlock the phone with his fingerprint, and then they would have sought his fingerprint to unlock the phone and then perform the data dump. Looking at, again, the factors in Hawkinson.
So your argument hinges on the, I don't want to say assumption, but on the belief that this third party would have sought his fingerprint instead of some other method of unlocking the phone?
It wouldn't even necessarily have been the third party, Your Honor. I mean, again, the Hawkinson looks at the failure, the deviation from policy as one of the factors. We could also look at the fact that the deputy had knowledge. He had the knowledge that he could have easily unlocked the phone with a fingerprint. He chose not to. He chose to go ahead, and despite being notified by the phone that subsequent unlock attempts would result in the destruction of data, he continued to put additional passwords in. He never availed himself of the use of Mr. Hansen's fingerprint. Looking at other factors in Hawkinson, I mean, again, you have the incentive here. You have the fact that there was a very clear request with an offer in this case by Mr. Hansen to unlock the phone. This, for whatever reason, law enforcement chose not to do that and instead to follow through with whatever they were deciding to do here, which is to try to use these passwords.
I'm a little curious to hear how you think we consider these actions from, is it a subjective? If we're looking at bad faith, don't we have to consider the subjective decisions or the subjective beliefs of the officer in this case? Or are you saying we can stand back and make an objective view of things and look at, well, Hansen says that there was this warning. An objective person reading that warning would have stopped. An objective person, if Hansen offered a fingerprint, would have done the finger. Or are we really just looking at whether the subjective conduct, the subjective beliefs was in bad faith?
So, and I think, Your Honor, again, you know, if the court is going to rely only on subjective beliefs of the officer, then there's probably never really a situation where the court's going to find bad faith. The reason that the analysis in Hawkinson is the way it is because there are situations, and this would be one of them, where an officer acts in a way where he maybe was not intending, he was not acting purposely to destroy data, but through his actions and his lack of either foresight or his lack of understanding or his disregarding, arguably recklessly, but in this case, at least knowing that the consequence would be the destruction of data, he chooses to act in that way. That would be considered bad faith under Hawkinson. And
so it sounds like you're saying we have to consider the objective, what an objective officer would do.
That's correct, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very well. I see no other questions. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our